Hello everyone and welcome to the Highland Gamescast. We are a few days out from E3 and today we have a very special guest, Grant Kirkhope. So for those who may not know you, Grant, go ahead and introduce yourself. Why should everyone love you?
I'm not convinced there's a reason at all everyone should love me, really.
No,
I'm a composer. I guess I started at Rare in 1995, in the Dark Ages. And I did Banjo-Kazooie and GoldenEye and Donkey Kong 64 and Perfect Dark and Banjo-Tooie and Viva Pinata, Grabbed by the Ghoulies. Shall I go on? Kingdoms of Amalur, Reckoning, Civilization, did some other stuff. And I guess most recently I've just done the Mario Rabbids for Ubisoft and the Donkey Kong DLC for that game. And also I've just done a tune for Banjo-Kazooie being in Smash Brothers.
Yeah, so I guess starting from the very, very beginning, what was it like for you when you first got into the music gaming industry? Or were you starting out with your own musical career and then you kind of fell into the video game side of things? How did that first start for you?
It was exactly that. So I went to university to do a music degree, and I left university at 22. And then I spent the next 11 years on and off unemployment insurance, you call it here, we call it the dole in the UK. And I spent most of that 11 years playing in like rock bands and stuff, metal bands and all that kind of stuff on guitar.
Nice.
Some bands on trumpet as well, playing around, doing stuff. Some bands did really well, some bands did terribly. But we ended up like, you know, one of the bands I played for in the UK was called Little Angels, who were quite a big UK rock band. They didn't make it in America. But we ended up, you know, being the opening act for Bon Jovi on a 7-week tour and a Van Halen on a 6-week tour and ZZ Top and Brad Adams and people like that. So we did like some gigantic stadium shows that were like, you know, 80,000 people, especially on the Bon Jovi tour and the Van Halen tour. Gigantic gigs like that. So I did that for quite a long time. And, you know, that I just kind of thought that's what I was going to do. I ended up being playing in bands at some point and I'd just be a tramp at some point at the end of it all when it all collapsed. And then my friend Robin Beanland, who we played in local bands together in North Yorkshire, he was a keyboard player and he announced that one day he'd got a job and, like, you know, no one I knew got a job. Everyone that I knew just played in bands and was on and off unemployment benefit, you know, and that was it. We were all very poor and that was it. So it's great when you're on tour, and not so great when you're on tour, you know, off tour, sorry. So he said, yeah, I've got a job. I'm going to go and work at a company called Rare in the Midlands and write music for computer games. I was like, what? That's a thing? I mean, I didn't think that was a job. I mean, I played a lot of games at the time, but I just never really thought about the music. So about a year and a half had gone by. He said to me, you know, Greg, you've been on the, you know, on the unemployment benefit about 11 years. You don't you think it's time you got a proper job, you know? And I was a bit like, well, I guess, but, you know, what can I do? He said, well, why don't you try to do what I'm doing, write music for video games? And I was a bit like, I don't know, how do you do that, you know? So he recommended that I bought an Atari ST with a meg of RAM, which is a load of RAM in those days, and a copy of Cubase, which is a sequencing program. I bought an EMU Proteus FX synthesizer module. And I set about writing music that I thought was right for video games. And so over the course of that, about a year, I sent Rare 5 cassette tapes because he worked there. And I only thought I could work there, nobody else, because he was there. And I never heard got a reply once. And then out of the blue, I got a letter saying, please come for an interview. So I drove down the 100 or so miles, or whatever it was, I can't remember, 60 miles, I can't remember, to Rare. And Dave Wise actually interviewed me with Simon Farmer, who was the general manager. And that was on a Friday. And I got a letter on the Monday saying I got the job. Couldn't believe it. So it was complete fluke. It wasn't for Robin saying, you know, why don't you ever go at this? I've never done it. So absolute fluke. I would still be playing in pub rock bands for £35 a night probably if I hadn't done that. So wow. It's pretty weird, really.
It's funny to think that that's sort of the starting point, you know, because you sort of look back on this, I don't know, that what people kind of see as the token Grant Kirkhope sound, which is sort of very whimsical, very fun, very nostalgic sound, or maybe at least for that's me at least, but and then trying to imagine that in this metal band, you know, just it's a very interesting sort of contrast there.
Yeah, no, I guess the metal bands I played for didn't sound like that.
No, I imagine not. I don't imagine many marimbas in metal bands, right?
But I think I had, because I did, like, I was classically trained from 6 years of old, I started playing trumpet, right? So I did the full kind of, you know, through school classic trumpet player, classical. So when I went to university, I just studied classical trumpet. So I had all that orchestral training from 6 all the way through to 22. So that's why I think I've made the jump to orchestra quite easily. It didn't seem odd to me because I was just so used to it. So I don't know. I had that kind of weird thing where I was metal and classical at the same time. So I guess it's a little bit odd. So I guess it's just doing a good stead all these
years. It worked out wonderfully, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, Jesse, I chimed in, but you were going to say something.
No, I was just going to say, with your influence going in whenever you first started with making the music for the games, you mentioned your band had more of a heavier rock sound, which is, as Daniel mentioned, very different from what we hear from those early games. Did you go in with more of a rock-inspired soundtrack in mind or songs in mind, and then getting feedback from them kind of influenced the way that the songs actually ended up becoming? Or was it more you just thinking that a different type of approach was necessary for the music for the games?
Well, my first game really was... I mean, I did convert Dave Wise's tunes from... Diddy Kong's Quest to the original Game Boy. That's my first job at Rare. But my first real game was GoldenEye. And also, in the meantime, I was kind of hired at Rare because they needed some guitar parts for Killer Instinct 2 that Robin was doing at the time. So I did the guitar parts on the arcade machine. I was the guitar player on that. I did trumpet on that as well. I played trumpet too on that as well. I did that in doing the Game Boy at the same time. And then it was decided that I should do GoldenEye because Graham Norgate, who was doing GoldenEye and Blast Corps at the same time, was getting really busy on Blast Corps and said, you know, I need to give up GoldenEye for a little while. Can you sort of take over while I'm sort of getting Blast Corps done? And I was like, of course, I'd love to, you know. So I guess GoldenEye is a bit rocky. Like, it's got some rock guitar in it. And the guitar at the start of the game that plays is me playing the guitar. So, you know, I was good rock stuff. It wasn't until I came to do Banjo-Kazooie that I had to work out to do something else. So, you know, I played a lot of games. So I knew what platform games sounded like, you know. But at first, you know, Banjo-Kazooie was Dream, so it was a very sort of RPG Zelda-esque. It wasn't really like it turned out. It wasn't until it switched to Banjo that I realized all the music I wrote for Dream was not, I couldn't use it, so I had to start again. So I kind of, my first tune for Banjo-Kazooie was the Click Clock Woods tune. So when they switched to Banjo, full on platformer, Tim Stamper, who's the head of the company, and Greg Males, who's the lead designer on Banjo, said, you need to write some platform music now. You've written some RPG stuff for us over this last year and a half, 2 years, whatever it was. But we need to have platform music now. So I had to kind of come up with something. So I was trying to find just a jolly tune that I thought would fit a platform game. There was nothing to look at, really. Mm-hmm. So I wrote that and they said, yeah, that sounds about right. And then I forgot about it. And I went back to start on the game. And when I wrote Mumbo's Mountain and Treasure Trove Cove, they sounded very different to the versions in the game. I had different tunes for those two. It wasn't really until the next level, is that Bubblegum Swamp, I forget which comes next, when I hit upon that kind of quirky, oddball sound. So when I hit on that, I thought, oh, this really fits the kind of oddball character they are. And also, I listened to Danny Elfman, Beetlejuice a lot, and that had that kind of quirky oddballness to it. And I felt, I thought it would match Banjo-Kazooie really, really well. So I did the rest of the game like that. And at the end, I came back to Chris Stamper, Stamper's brother. I said, we think the first two levels don't fit with the rest of the game, so I went back and redid this. I did Mumbo's Mountain and Treasure Trove Cove to make them more quirky to fit with the rest of the soundtrack. But when we got to Click Clock Woods, I kind of felt that tune that I'd written at the start sort of fitted that level. So I just went, oh, let's just use this, and it kind of fitted. So that's why that turned up in the game later. And it's not that quirky; it's more jolly-ish. In my head, I said it doesn't sound as quirky, but I kind of felt it fitted the level. So that's why that returned to the game, and the rest of it's just, you know, as it was.
All right, Ilya, since we're going in order, I suppose, do you have a question? That way we don't keep talking over you.
No, it's all fine. I'm trying to think of which one I want to pick of the ones that I sent. Okay, since I asked this as a dancer and a choreographer myself, so I always like to know what inspires other artists in their line of work. So when you're composing music, what tends to be your main source of inspiration? Like, is it the look of the game? Is it something that you've been inspired by in the past? Or, yeah, what inspires you to make the game sound the way it does?
I think it could be all of those things, or any of those things. Like, sometimes with games, they might give you some video to watch. You might get to play a level if you got the dev kit. You might get to see some artwork. If there's no artwork, you might just write a description. But I kind of feel that, you know, I've been composing like 25 years now, because I'm super old, right? Obviously, look at me. You know, so I mean, it's like, I kind of feel that any composer worth the salt, if someone says to me, "We've got a frozen ice castle," then straight away I'm going to be thinking about pizzicato strings, glockenspiel, chelesse, spiky instruments to go with the spikiness of the ice, right? Or if they say to me, "It's a lovely warm forest," I'm thinking about strings, long strings, and warm woodwinds that are all, you know, that's my mind conjures it up straight away. So even before I write a note, I've already thought about the instruments I might be using for that kind of thing. You know, so I think that, you know, it can be all of those things, but I don't think I need very much, you know, to get me going kind of thing. I think I can start off on a very brief that's not very informative, you know, like, whether this is a, it's a swamp, that's it. Do it, you know. So it's a bit, you know, like, I think on ukulele, the swamp level was like, it's a swamp, you know, we know what you're doing, just do a swamp tune, you know, like that.
I have a lot of faith in you there.
So, well, you know, I've known those guys for like 25 years,
oh,
you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's deserved, don't get me wrong.
No, but I mean, some people like still, you know, I really feel that I don't really adhere to that thing that because you've written good music in the past, you're going to be great again. I don't believe in that. I kind of feel like every project you try to prove yourself over again, because you might not write, you might have written your last great soundtrack and the next one's a shit from then onwards. It's completely possible, you know. So I really feel like I always try super hard, and I really hate that ego stuff, right? So I never think about that. I just think I'm hired as day one as a composer. They could not know me from Adam. I'm just going to start and work. And I always, and sometimes like with a lot of the guys I work for, I tend to sort of say, "Do you mind if I send you sort of 16 bars off the tune?" And then you can say to me, "It's in the right direction, it's not in the right direction," and you start again. So rather than writing a whole piece of music and they're going, "We hate it," and I've got to start all over again, I might send a little bit and say, "If you don't mind, if you listen to that, tell me if I'm in the right direction. If not, what direction would you like?" So it saves time that way. And I like to do that. It kind of gets, you know, I just feel like it's a better thing. I get more of an idea about what they want, you know.
Yeah.
And also, like, you know, people are surprisingly musically adept these days. Like, people do know, people have got very wide eclectic tastes due to the fact that you can buy a single track from any soundtrack or any record you want anywhere. Like, when I was a kid, I went out and bought a Queen album, and it was the entire album, and you got the entire thing. You couldn't buy that track separately. You just bought the album, right? These days, you can buy what you like. So people have got, like, Metallica next to Lady Gaga, next to, I don't know, next to something, you know what I mean? So it's, I feel like I like that people have got huge eclectic tastes, so they can sort of say, if I can't quite get the direction, I'll say, "Well, tell me about a track you like. What track is it?" Or tell me about a movie scene that you think's in the right direction. So there's tons of reference points. I think when I started, that wasn't so prevalent, you know.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. We have a question from a fan on Twitter, which you may have seen the tweet. You were tagged in it as well, but Francisco asks, "I'd like to know what inspired his signature tritone harmony and what made him use that same style for the banjo series in general."
So I kind of hit upon that later with the Danny Elfman thing. So I listened to quite a lot of Danny Elfman, like Batman especially, and Beetlejuice at the time. So Batman kind of inspired Mad Monster Mansion, and Beetlejuice kind of inspired, you know, roughly the rest of the banjo soundtracks. But the more, you know, I'm not really a very intellectual composer, so I don't really think about things too deeply. But when it came to banjo, I kind of thought there were opposites. Like, kazoo was clever and sarcastic, banjo was a bit dumb, right? So I kind of thought I needed to represent that in the music somehow. And the furthest point from a C, if it's in C major, the furthest point from a C is an F sharp, which is a tritone. I don't know music in a lot, but that's what it's called. So augmented fourth, diminished fifth, whatever, I guess they're the same. So I kind of thought those two notes are the furthest point apart, because if you go past that, it gets closer to the C above it. If you get below it, it's closer to the C below it. So that's the exact midpoint between two Cs in an octave. So I kind of thought I need to use those intervals, and that's what kind of sparked the whole tritone thing. You know, people sort of think that I invented it, and that's complete nonsense. It's been used for like hundreds of years, you know. I just stole it from somebody else, that's all. it's not like I'm particularly clever like that. But that's how it kind of came around. And I liked the way it's, and I kind of thought that we were trying to make a platform game that would maybe beat Mario, right? Mario 64, which is, you know, impossible because it's such a brilliant game. But I was trying to think, I can't write that kind of jolly poppy jazz that they do, because Nintendo do that. Koji Kondo writes that so fantastically well. I could never do that. So I'm just not good enough to do that. So I kind of thought I needed to find my little thing that might be me. You know, I didn't think, like, you know, 25 years later, people would still be talking about it. I thought it'd be like gone in 5 seconds flat, you know.
Oh, no. Left quite an impression on a very young Daniel.
And me.
You don't think like that. You just think, I'm glad to have a job and to keep the job by writing music that everyone likes at the time, and get to make the next game without getting fired, right? That's what I was thinking, yeah. You know. So, that was it. I was thinking of the opposite characters, and that's what kind of came around.
All right. So you mentioned you were just trying to write the song for the moment, thinking this has to be good enough not to get fired, get on the next project, write that. What was the first game that you were writing a soundtrack for that you really started feeling the pressure that this is going to be probably the biggest game at the time that I've been writing for? I need to get this perfect so everyone likes it, or else everyone playing the game's going to, like, turn down the volume while they're actually playing the game or something. Did you ever have that feeling? And what game was it on?
Honestly, it was Mario Rabbids.
Mario Rabbids?
Really? Yeah, I don't get stressed. Well, I don't feel like that very often. And it's Mario Rabbids because, obviously, Koji Kondo's written fantastic Mario music forever, right? And when they first told me it's a Mario game, I nearly shit myself. I was like, oh my God, how on earth am I going to write a piece of write music that's going to be as good as Koji Kondo? It's just, you know, it's a waste of time. I'm never going to do it, you know. And I really panicked for quite a while thinking I'm never going to do this. So that was the first time I kind of felt a bit kind of scared about it. I haven't felt like that before. So I've done Donkey Kong and that was all right, you know, and it wasn't so much that, but Mario especially was like, he's the best known video game character in the world, right, probably. And Koji Kondo is completely brilliant. And, you know, for me to try and attempt to do something like him would be like, everyone's going to hate me, even my kids. My kids
No.
I was just like, to write something where my kids, you know, don't stop talking to me. I mean, not that they talked to me much in the first place, but, you know, I had to find something that, you know, they would pay for it, you know. So, I mean, it turned out all right in the end, but I guess at the start I was pretty nervous thinking, how am I going to do this? Especially with Nintendo are overseeing it as well, you know. You're thinking, oh my God, they're just going to hate me now, right? You know. So yeah, Mario was the first time I felt it. I think throughout Rare, I was all right. I mean, even like in 1 year at Rare, I got to do Banjo Tooie, Donkey Kong 64, and Perfect Dark all in the same year. I was all right.
Oh wow,
busy, man.
it was hard, but I was all right with it. I think that Mario Rabbids was the first time I kind of shit myself, really.
It's funny. My wife loves that game, by the way. But no, I do too. I gave it a very good review, but it's funny because when I was first playing through that, I was like, oh yeah, this is very good. And I'm fighting the DK boss, the Rabbit Kong, and I'm just like, hey, this song is familiar. This track is from DK64. And I'm kind of humming along with the most of the soundtracks. And then I look it up on the internet. I'm like, oh, it all makes sense. Like, everything clicked into place. There's like, no wonder I'm just like playing the game the whole time, being like, it's those tunes you can just hum so easily, you know, and it's.
What can I say? I'm a one-trick pony. What can I say?
No. It's not at all. It's brilliant. So,
I think, you know, with that game, I was trying not to be too me, if you know what I mean. I couldn't make it like Banjo. So there's maybe a couple of tracks that you could sort of say were Banjo, especially the mid-boss Mayhem. That was like a real kind of. Mm-hmm. I did that because Davide, the creative director, is a massive Banjo fan. I thought I need to do one tune for him that's like Banjo. Mm-hmm. But the rest, I guess, is a bit. I think, you know, as a composer, I think that. Like, when I hear Brian May play the guitar, right, I know it's him just by the way. I can spot it a mile away because he's phrasing the way he's got vibrato, or like Eddie Van Halen. You know, my heroes, I can spot them a mile away. And I kind of feel that composers or musicians, some things in your head just come out in what you do. You can't help that. I write music a certain way, and it's probably going to have a bit of that me in it somewhere, you know. Even when I try not to, it's still going to be somewhere, you know. So. I think you like certain chords, you like certain melody structures, you know, just the way it comes out, really. You know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. It definitely shines in all the marimbas. So every time,
I love the marimba.
it always gets me. I do have a quick question. I guess this one's a bit on a, I guess more on a technical level, but I noticed in some games, especially a good example of it is in Banjo-Kazooie, there's some tracks where they're a bit transformative, where they, like, especially in Gruntilda's lair, where it'll start out with one sort of instrumentation, and as you move into another area, the song, it remains the same track, but the instrumentation all, like, transforms and stuff. And was that something that you found on a technical level was difficult to achieve, or was that just, like, this amazing brainchild you had and put it in there, and everyone was like, oh, great, or what was the process there, I guess?
Yeah, again, I stole that from somebody else, like you did.
Right.
When I first got to Rare, like, Greg and Tim were massive LucasArts fans, and so I played all the LucasArts games at the time, like, you know, Day of the Tentacle, you know, Full Throttle, all those kind of games, the Indiana Jones game. I love those point and click, they're just brilliant adventures. And especially the, what's the bloody name of the bloody pirate game? I've forgotten it.
I forgot the name of it as well.
I don't recall, actually.
You know what's funny? I can't remember, I've just forgotten the name of the video. What's, I have to look it up now. I can't remember, I've just forgotten that. Tip of my tongue, that is. Secret Monkey Island. Secret Monkey Island. So in these games, they had a system called iMuse, which was, as you wondered about, it was the exact same thing. The music morphed to where you were going to. So they were using FM synthesizer, and it was just the chip on the card. It wasn't like, you know. So Tim and Greg said, that's great, you need to do that. And I was like, all right. So I had to work out how to do it. So it wasn't that hard when I kind of got to grips with it, but it starts thinking, oh, Christ, this is beyond me. I'm never going to manage it, you know. So the way we did it was, in a MIDI file, you've got 16 tracks or channels, whatever you want to call them. And each track has got a different instrument on it. So I'd write my piece of music, and I'd say to Greg, you know, in the level, how many areas are there? 3 levels, 4 levels. And I'd allocate channels to levels. So let's say the first level's tracks 1, 5, and 6, let's say. There was a clarinet, a drum, and something else, I don't know. And the next area is 4, 2, and 10, like that. So I write it all out like that. So I'd allocate tracks in the MIDI file to each area, and then the programmer would be able, we drew like big circles in the level that you can't see, and when you cross a circle, it crossfades from one set of channels to the next set of channels, so it's completely seamless. And so like there's always been like, I usually had a channel of ambience at the bottom, like channel 16 would be like, if it'd be birds and stuff tweeting, or the waves in Treasure Trove Cove, something like that. I'd have a channel of harp, so you can go underwater.
Right.
So I had 14 channels left for the level, which is not that many, really. If you're allocating like 4 to this and 3 to that and 2 to that, soon eats through it, you know. So that's how you did it. And it was just like a hexadecimal number that would get, the game would pick up. It would just crossfade from 2, 3, and 4 to 5, 6, and 8. So it was completely seamless on that. So it works fantastically well. And when we did Banjo-Tooie, we found a way, Will Bryan, who's a programmer, then found a way to stick 2 MIDI files together, so it's 32 channels. So I had much more to play with. So when you go to like Grunty Land, what's it called? Grunty's Fun Fair, that one in Banjo-Tooie, that's got lots of different areas, but the music never reloads. It just keeps playing because I've got so many more channels to play with. I could go to more areas and keep it going. So like in Grunty's, you know, thing in the first game, I had to sometimes restart the tune because we ran out of channels. We didn't have enough channels to cover all the areas in the game in Grunty's lair, you know. So yeah, that's how I did it. But you know, it was all stolen from LucasArts iMuse. It's nothing to do with me.
Oh, well, I mean, you implemented it very memorably. You know, I think again, that might be something people maybe credit you with inventing. But
I'm completely honest. We still just haven't met the composers from those days before, so we completely stole it. You know, it was all.
Okay. See, all great artists steal something, right? So, and that's then true. Own it, right? So, yes.
All right, Ilya, I guess we're at your question now. Nope, she's frozen. No, there she is.
Oh, what? I am back.
Yes. Do you have another of your questions picked out?
Yes, I do. All right. That's a tough question.
We'll probably do a couple more, and then we'll end it for Grant here, since we started kind of late.
Okay. You actually already asked that one, so that's good. Okay, is there a particular gaming soundtrack that you are most proud of or most attached to,
You know, that's a hard one, that is, because I kind of feel that I've been really lucky at the games I've worked on. I do like all of them, I mean, genuinely speaking. I guess I'll have to say a few. I'll have to say, of course, Banjo-Kazooie, because it's lasted such a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And it's super close to my heart. I think working on Mario Rabbids was also super special, because to get to work with Mario, you know, as a composer, that's unbelievable. And also, that general experience was great. Davide Soleani and the team in Milan and the team in Paris are absolutely fantastic people. They're tons of fun, really passionate, put the balls completely on the line on that game. They really went for it, even the ladies. It was absolutely fantastic. And also, I guess, Viva Pinata, because that's the first time I got to write with a live orchestra. So... And I like writing that kind of pastoral. It's my take on Elgar, Vaughan Williams, the kind of English 20th century English composers. That, you know, that was my kind of, even though I can't write like them because they're amazing. But like that was my little take on that kind of stuff that they do. So I love doing that one as well. You know, so but it's hard because I really, this hasn't been a game I haven't liked to compose. Honestly, I haven't liked to compose for. Every game I've done, I've actually genuinely enjoyed it. So I guess I'll say those three for this time.
Okay.
All right.
All right. After this, Daniel, think of your final question to wrap everything up with.
I've got it.
All right. So the question that I'm asking, it actually comes from the chat a bit earlier. Someone was asking about Banjo 3E. So not Nuts and Bolts, but if everyone that's watching remembers, whenever they showed off the GameCube tech demo at Space World or something like that, they showed off... a little clip of what was supposed to be the third Banjo game on GameCube, and then it ended up getting canceled when Microsoft purchased Rare, and then they started working on Nuts and Bolts, I believe. So for that initial, or the first version of Banjo 3, had you started writing any music for that, and then it transitioned to Nuts and Bolts, or?
I remember that.
You don't remember that?
Like I don't think we ever started Banjo 3. That's why I honestly think, because I certainly didn't work on it. Like, I don't know where that's come from. If it, cause I kind of feel like, you know, I was reasonably senior at Rare. I feel like I would have known about that. Like, I don't remember anything about Banjo. The first Banjo game that I worked on after 2 years was Nuts and Bolts. There was no Banjo 3. I don't know whether that was just like a tech demo. That's just what it was.
Yeah.
Like, I never did anything for that. I didn't start on it. Like, as far as I'm concerned, the Banjo team, the minute we finished Tui, we went straight on to Grab by the Ghoulies. Like, you know, literally the day when Banjo Tui was done, we got the design document from Greg saying, the next game's going to be a Haunted House game. It's going to be on the GameCube. And that's what we did. So I can't imagine anybody else at Rare working on Banjo without the Banjo team. So mm-hmm. I have to say that I just don't believe that. I mean, I guess it's possible that something happened, but I didn't know about it. But I just feel like it's a bit unlikely. And that's my only, I'm not trying to lie about it. That's what I honestly feel. There was no Banjo 3. I never saw any design document about that. Nothing. It was just grabbed by the Ghoulies straight onto, Nuts and Bolts. The art in between, maybe. Or was that, it was running concurrently at the time. We'll go both together. Both at the same time.
All right. Well, I hope the person who is asking, for that question, I hope that answered. And Daniel, your final question.
Yeah, so I think all the fans would be remiss if we didn't bring up the DK rap. Because...
I love it.
Because, no, we love it. I love it to bits. I have fond memories of my older brothers teasing me for loving it so much when we first got our N64. DK64 was one of the first games we actually got. We were a bit late on the boat, but I guess was that something where, you know, someone handed you a thing, they're like, make a funny intro that's kind of quirky with these DK characters, or was it something you kind of slipped in there and was like, hey guys, like, this will be kind of a fun thing to do? Or did they hate it, did they love it, you know, like when you first showed it off?
I think George Andreas was the assistant designer on Banjo, and then he got given Donkey Kong to do as a lead designer. Me and George are still very good friends to this day. I think on the snares, you know, when it starts up, so it kind of switches from the old DK to Dave Wise's new DK.
Yeah.
So the thing was, let's switch from the old DK to the new DK and DK64. At the time, you know, hip hop rap was very big in the late 90s. You know, it's a reasonably new music form, I guess, reasonably new. You know, so George was like, we need to do that. So he wrote the lyrics and he gave them to me, said, you know, off you go. And I was like, all right, let's see what I can do with this. So he originally wanted to be quite fast. Like there's a Run DMC Jason Nevins track called It's Like That, It's The Way It Is. It's quite a fast rap track. And he wanted to like that, and I was like, no, we don't want it like that. And I was going through my synthesis like that, and I found the drum beat.
Right.
And I kind of thought it was a bit like that Funky Cold Medina track at the time. I don't know if who did that. I can't remember who did it. So I kind of thought, for me, that was like rap music. I mean, I know nothing about rap music. I hate hip-hop. I'm a metal fan, right? So I was like, that sounds like it to me, even if it wasn't, as it wasn't, obviously. So I found that drum loop. So I'm going to use that drum loop. And I started telling George how the loops are going to go. So you and Chris Sutherland can do the rapping. I'll do the music and all that. We'll put it all together. And that's kind of as it was. And it's supposed to be like a bit of a laugh, you know, the monkeys rapping about, you know, pineapples and Christ knows what else, and you know, putting timpans in for the big guy and a slide trombone in for Lanky, and you know, it's put a joke, metal guitar for Diddy. It's all a big joke, right? And I was thinking, this is going to be fantastic when it comes out. People are going to love it. It's going to be perfect. Yeah. So of course, when it comes out, everybody thinks it's completely shit, right?
Except for this guy.
I think the young kids who didn't know what. The young kids who didn't know what credible rap music was were like, oh, this is rap. And anybody that knew what rap was going, this is not rap at all. So unfortunately, all the kind of, you know, teenage to older people thought I was having a real proper attempt at writing a proper hip hop track, which I wasn't.
No.
It's supposed to be a joke. So I was kind of like, you know, didn't anybody get the joke? You know, it's supposed to be a joke. So I guess really, you know, so I kept, at the time I was like, oh dear, that's gone a bit wrong. But I think that... you know, 20 years later, people like it now. I've had to wait 20 years, you know, for that thing. Yeah. Now, at the time, no one liked it. So I've had to wait all this time, you know. So where were you when I was, you know, I was crying?
I was at home listening to it.
I was crying, going on my career's over.
Oh, no.
He's just pressing reset on the 64 to hear it again.
I was.
Oh, my brothers and I did it too. The first time we heard it, we all went, oh, they said hell. We were all...
That's a weird thing too, because the UK, like, no one thinks hell's a curse word. Like, no one thinks that. It's so weird in America, being picked up on that. We were like, we thought that was weird. You know, that kids are saying, oh, hell, it's just not a curse word. So that was strange. And I guess that it got changed in the Smash Brothers versions later on to heck, didn't it? You know? But like that's something that we never crossed our minds. You know, we put so much other innuendo into the games that everyone missed. You know, we thought that no, people got it straight away. You know, it's a bit peculiar, really. So, you know, like, you know, it's really touching. I've seen that speedrun thing where the whole people in Australia started doing the Deka rap, you know, unannounced, did it all together online, and it really did bring a tear to my eye. I was watching that, thinking, you know, everybody in the room's doing the GK rap. It was just amazing. So, you know, as I say, it's funny now. It wasn't so funny then.
There is...
I love it.
There is an amazing a cross cover, I guess, where someone mixed Bohemian Rhapsody with the DK rap. Yes. Yeah, and it is absolutely perfect.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, no matter how... If I write something amazing in the future, I still feel it'll be eclipsed by the DK rap. on my tombstone, it's going to say, "Here lies a body of Grant Kirkup. He wrote the DK rap." That's what else do? That's going to be.
That's got to make it happen. And we've got it recorded now. So.
Underlined at the very bottom, he's the leader of the DK crew. All right. So before we head out, Grant, where can people find more of you on Twitter or Instagram? If you have one, where can they follow you to keep up with all of your work? And what's something coming up in the future or the near future, a project or something that you're working on that you would like everyone to look forward to?
I'm at Grant Kirkup on Twitter. I'm Grant Kirkup Composer on Instagram. I do have a website, grantkirkup.com. So I've just done Ukulele and the Possible Lair, so that's coming up. So I guess that's all I can talk about, really. Me and Dave Wise did that again with the two composers that work at Playtonic, Dan and Matt. So it's all four of us done that one. I've done the Overworld, the 3D Overworld. Dave's done a lot of the 2D levels, and the guys did the rest of it. So I guess that's the next thing you'll hear from me, probably. Apart from, of course, Banjo in Smash, which I did that one for that tune for Smash for the reveal and in the game as well. So that was cool. Yeah, so that's what I've done.
All right, and with that, thank you so much for coming on. Sorry again for starting about 15 minutes late. We had some technical issues, and then I guess Tubes ended up not being able to join us after all. So hope she gets to feeling better. But
I don't know what goes wrong, don't worry. goes wrong for me all the time.
I always say it's not a real podcast unless we have technical difficulties. So.
Yeah, you're right.
All right, and once again, thank you so much. And with that, everyone, I guess we're out.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to me.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on.
Anytime. All right.
See you, Grant.
Have a good night.
Have a good night.